Everyone knows someone who is struggling with mental illness, yet the stigma of admitting it and seeking treatment continues. Today we have the radio premiere of a speech by the famous Canadian broadcaster, politician, and diplomat, Stephen Lewis. His topic is human rights for people with mental illness. We were fortunate to get this speech from a major symposium held January 29, 2007, in Surrey, British Columbia. It was organized by Stenberg College and Coast Mental Health, with support from Semiahu House Society and Van Net Community Newspapers. The evening speeches were filmed and webcast live by Channel M in Vancouver. Stephen Lewis is currently Social Science Scholar in Residence at McMaster University, having completed his term as United Nations Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. We'll be hearing about his impression of AIDS in Africa as well. Let's join the large crowd at the symposium as Stephen Lewis is introduced.
Dr. Goldblum, thank you so very much, and we are so pleased and grateful that you are a man of such optimism and such spirit. I think those are the qualities that are going to take us to the day eventually where we will find that we feel as comfortable talking about depression or our schizophrenia as we do about our heart condition or our diabetes. In the interest of time, let me get right to introducing our keynote speaker this evening, Mr. Stephen Lewis. Stephen Lewis is a humanitarian who has long worked to improve the human condition, both here at home and abroad. Leader of the Ontario New Democratic Party for 8 years, and no, that's not the abroad part, during which time he became leader of the official opposition. He has served as Canada's ambassador to the United Nations and as the deputy executive director of UNICEF in New York. He's the former UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa, a post he held from June of 2001 to the end of 2006. In 2006, Stephen Lewis became the inaugural scholar in residence at the Institute of Globalization and the Human Condition at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Mr. Lewis is co-chair of the Leadership Program Committee for the 17th International AIDS Conference, which will be held in Mexico City in August of 2008. He is also a member of the board of directors of the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. And Mr. Lewis is the chair of the board of the Stephen Lewis Foundation, which is dedicated to easing the pain of HIV/AIDS in Africa. Stephen Lewis is a companion of the Order of Canada, our country's highest honor for lifetime achievement. And he's not that old. In 2003, Maclean's magazine chose Mr. Lewis as their inaugural Canadian of the Year. In April 2005, Mr. Lewis was named by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. He holds 24 honorary degrees from Canadian universities. He is an honorary fellow of the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada and a senior fellow of Massey College. And finally, he is an author. Stephen Lewis's book, Race Against Time, was recognized last year by the Canadian Booksellers Association as the Book of the Year, and wouldn't you know, he was honored as the Author of the Year. Admired by Canadians of all political stripes, he has garnered respect and attention internationally for the strength and the eloquence with which he presents his convictions. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Stephen Lewis.
Thank you. Thank you immensely, and thank you for so generous and friendly and gently hyperbolic an introduction. I'm very pleased to be here, and I am especially pleased to have had the privilege of hearing Dr. David Goldblum. I was entirely fascinated by that talk, and learned a great deal. One of the things I learned is the adroit skill of the psychiatric temperament, because having expressed his anxiety about being given the title psychosociophobia, or whatever it is, I noticed that the word did not then cross his lips for the rest of the speech. And it occurred to me that that was a most appropriate intellectual finesse. I, like David, am indebted to Coast and to Stenberg College for this invitation. And many things were triggered in my mind as Professor Goldblum spoke. I spent the last 5.5 years dealing with stigma, watching people living with the HIV/AIDS pandemic, struggling with stigma every hour of the day, and it remains one of the most appalling dimensions of the pandemic. And the blame to which Professor Goldblum referred, which is applied to people with the virus, particularly because it is sexually contracted and therefore they are blamed for misdeeds, is something that deeply frustrates our capacity to respond. And one of the insights which he shared with you struck me as I listened to be particularly apt, because the one occasion in Africa where I have seen stigma largely removed was in the presence of a particular treatment facility run by Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, in a little northern community called Arua in the country of Uganda, where after 2 years of intensive treatment of those who were living with the virus and required treatment, and a tremendous campaign to get people tested so that they knew their status, whether they were HIV positive or HIV negative, and an equally intensive effort to spread the message of prevention throughout the community. When the community came together on the second anniversary of the arrival of Doctors Without Borders, the celebratory spirit was overwhelming, and the sense in the community of release from stigma, the sense that everyone knew where everyone else stood and no one was attributing blame, and there was a tremendous measure of mutual solidarity as I have seen nowhere else, demonstrated to me that that intense human contact to which Professor Goldblum made reference is, of course, what does ultimately overcome the stigma in society which so deeply prejudices the issue of mental illness and which prejudices all such related matters. I was equally fascinated by his description of the responses of the 52 boys and 52 girls to the otherwise neutral pictures, except for the way in which they were labeled. And I wondered, when I'm finished, Professor Goldblum, whether you'll be able to distinguish for me how the boys answered and how the girls answered. Because if, in fact, acculturation was, as we would assume in the earliest years, allowing boys to be deeply aggressive, then their responses were probably somewhat different. I also got a kick out of the reference to Richard Nixon. I haven't heard Richard Nixon's name for a very long time. It plumbed the depths not of nostalgia, but of inching into my dotage. And I reflected on a particular anecdote which I would like to share with you. When I was Canada's representative at the United Nations, when I was a mock diplomat, a pretend diplomat, one of the things we did on a regular occasion was to say goodbye to our colleagues who were leaving the office. And a fellow named Joseph Werner Reed, who was then the third ambassador for the United States to the United Nations. The United States, believe it or not, has 5 ambassadors to the United Nations at any given moment, although only one of them achieves a certain notoriety. Joseph, who was number 3, was leaving the United Nations, and I was invited to a privileged luncheon to say goodbye. The luncheon was held at the home of the senior ambassador to the UN from the United States, a man named General Vernon Walters. And he occupied the residence of the United States, which is at the top floor of the Waldorf Astoria Towers, a marginally resplendent environment. And I went up the elevator of the Waldorf Astoria Towers, and it opened up onto only one apartment at the top floor. And the door swung open, and there was General Vernon Walters right in front of me, and he said, quote, "Oh, Mr. Ambassador, meet the President." And standing in front of me hand outstretched, beady eyes fixed on my persona, was Richard Nixon. I knew at that precise moment in time that it was my hand or my marriage. I gave Richard Nixon the limpest handshake he has ever received in his entire infamous political career. And I then begged everyone not to tell my wife about it. And finally, I smiled when Professor Goldblum made reference to the fact of being in hospitals and people asking, how do you tell the doctors from the patients? And I was reminded, this is a true story, of campaigning with Tommy Douglas in Saskatchewan in the 1956 election. He was representing the riding of Weyburn, which at the time had what was called then the Weyburn Psychiatric Hospital. And I was campaigning in the hospital with Tommy as he went genially through the corridors, shaking hands with everyone he could find and who presented themselves. And he went up to one fellow and he put out his hand and he said, hello, I'm Tommy Douglas, Premier of Saskatchewan. And the fellow looked at him and said, how good to meet you. I'm Napoleon Bonaparte. And there was about it such a delicious moment of shared and mutual skepticism that it has lived with me to this day. The lovely thing about politicking in Saskatchewan is, of course, it is resplendent with stories. In that very same campaign, now that you've started me, there will be no stopping. And I'm in a very deeply Castro-like phase these days. I speak at inordinate length, and for those of you who desire a coffee, you'd like a break, go outside, come back in a little while, I'll still be speaking. I was in that very campaign when they told the wonderful story. There had been some serious flooding and rains in the Capel Valley, and Ross Thatcher, who was the leader then of the Liberal Party, about to become premier a few years thereafter, was deciding to show his depth of sympathy with the public in Saskatchewan, and he thought he'd go up in a plane and fly over the Capel Valley and be able to report directly on the human loss and disarray which the rains and the flooding had caused. And he went up in the plane with the pilot, and he looked down at the devastation beneath him, and he said, oh my God, this is terrible. I think I'm going to throw a $100 bill out the window and make some farmer happy. And then he stopped himself and he said, no, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to throw 10 $10 bills out the window and make 10 farmers happy. And then he stopped again, and with a beatific smile on his face, he said, nah, I'm going to throw 100 $1 bills out the window and make 100 farmers happy. To which the pilot said, why the hell don't you throw yourself out the window and make everybody happy? It's not that I'm entirely punchy, it's only that I'm a trifle jet-lagged. And I want you to allow the milk of human kindness to flow through your veins and treat me with compassion. I heard Professor Goldblum. I did not hear the predecessor speakers. I apologize for that. I therefore come to you without a grip on what preceded me in full. And if I engage in repetitive banality, I beg your forgiveness. I want to explore a number of disparate themes. I'm going to speak with an almost supernatural rapidity to cover the subject matters I'd like to cover. And I'm going to choose as my context the quote that was used at the beginning of the Senate committee's report, Out of the Shadows, which was taken from the Canadian Mental Health Association's document, More from the Mind, and reads, quote, in no other field has there been as much confusion, misdirection, and discrimination against the patient as in mental illness, close quote. Indeed, the only field which they judged to be comparable was that of leprosy. And I must say the only field I could judge to be comparable is that of the HIV and AIDS pandemic. They describe the response to mental illness and the feeling of those who are dealing with mental illness to be cast to wander in the wilderness, a crime to be punished, possessing demons to be exorcised, a disgrace to be hushed up. And the Senate authors of Out of the Shadows make the point that these comments were 50 years old, and yet they seem applicable and germane today. And it is shocking. It is shocking that so little has changed in attitudes to mental illness and in the stigma which was so eloquently described. And if all of us were assuming or hoping that the evolution of human rights would be a way of mitigating the consequences of society's response to mental illness, we'd be wrong. Because for reasons which are sometimes incomprehensible, the entire custody of the human rights dimension demonstrates very little progress at all. It isn't that I'm not an optimist, it's only that I ricochet between optimism and despair. And when I read the record of human rights and mental illness, it does induce a certain degree of despair. Because, of course, within the compendium of rights as we know them, it should have been possible to protect the rights of the mentally ill and to give them a chance for either a full recovery or a chronic recovery, as Professor Goldblum pointed out. But I want to remind you, number one, that we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which says that everyone has a right to a standard of living adequate for his or her health, and all people are free and equal in rights and dignity. And those unqualified, explicit statements form the base for the further elaboration of human rights, which inevitably followed, primarily in two great international covenants. The first was the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. And Article 12 reads as follows. States parties, that is, governments, recognize the right of everyone to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. And within that covenant, there is an obligation to make those rights real, to make those rights operational, to make those rights happen. And it's unusual in an international covenant to have the phrase physical and mental rights used, or mental health used. It is not unusual to use the phrase the highest attainable standard of health. That is a phrase which is used in one convention after another. But it was first etched into the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and along with the Bill of Rights, they stood as a bastion to protect people from stigma and discrimination and egregious violation of their rights. The second international covenant is on civil and political rights, and it simply reaffirms what the Universal Declaration and the adjacent covenant have inscribed, but goes on in a couple of articles to make other points which are fundamental to the protection of the rights of people who are mentally ill. Quote, Article 7, no one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. In particular, no one shall be subjected without his or her free consent to medical or scientific experimentation. And the implications, of course, are clear to all of those of you who labor in the fields of mental illness and mental health. Article 26 says, all persons are equal before the law and are entitled without any discrimination to equal protection from the law. In this respect, the law shall prohibit any discrimination and guarantee to all persons protection against discrimination on any ground, such as race, color, sex, or other status. And it is explicitly indicated in the various rulings applicable to that convention that the words "or other status" include the meaning of mental illness.
Taken together, the two covenants and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights constitute a kind of Bill of Rights for the world. And the covenants are ratified by governments, by a great majority of governments in the world. And when you ratify an international convention or an international covenant, it means that you yourself as a country are governed by its contents. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a matter of international common law, and it carries the standing of covenants which have been ratified. Subsequently, these affirmations of the right to health, of absolute equality and entitlement to everyone in society without any abbreviation or qualification, these rights were further elaborated by a succession of statements and conventions and rules and regulations and imprimaturs which flowed from the international community. They were reinforced over and over again. In 1991, the United Nations General Assembly passed what it called Principles for the Protection of Persons with Mental Illness. People don't even know that these principles by and large exist and have been asserted in an unqualified fashion. Listen to one of them. All persons with mental illness shall be treated with humanity and respect for the inherent dignity of the human person. There shall be no discrimination on the grounds of mental illness. And that was passed by the United Nations General Assembly in 1991 without a single dissenting vote. In other words, there is etched into the ethos of the International Human Rights Compendium an absolute guarantee of the protection of rights for the mentally ill.
This is CFRO 102.7 Co-op Radio, broadcasting from Vancouver, Canada, for caring people like you. You are listening to a Canadian broadcaster, politician, and diplomat, Stephen Lewis, speaking at Realizing Our Potential, a symposium on human rights for people with mental illness, January 29, 2007. This recording is courtesy of Stenberg College and Coast Mental Health and made by Channel M. Let's return to Stephen Lewis.
In 1993, there was another United Nations General Assembly resolution which talked of the standard rules on equalization of opportunities for people with disabilities, and the broad definition of disabilities incorporated mental illness. And it asserted the right to participate in everything on the part of the mentally ill, including the drafting of legislation which would govern their own situations. In Vienna, in 1993, we had a major international conference on human rights. I actually attended that conference. And in the course of the conference, because of the debate around mental health and mental illness, the following declaration emerged. All human rights are universal and therefore unreservedly include people with disabilities, which includes the mentally ill. In other words, there was no wish anywhere to abridge the sense of the entitlement of full human rights and full protection. We have had in the aftermath special rapporteurs on mental health and mental illness appointed by the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. We've had regional conventions emerge in Africa, in Latin America, in Europe, which enshrine the same rights for all. We've had treaty bodies under these conventions, groups of experts who make declarations about the content of the convention, and in every single instance, they affirm the rights and the protections of the mentally ill. And we've had some remarkable new international covenants which have been ratified by the vast majority of countries in the world. The Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on the Rights of the Child. All of these international conventions affirm without any hesitation whatsoever the human rights of the mentally ill. And you would think that cumulatively, over time, it would have had an impact. You would think that countries which ratify these conventions and are therefore bound by their provisions as a matter of binding international law, Canada included, you would think that we would respond in a way which would respect the human rights that are at the heart of the conventions themselves. And as all of you know with this audience, simply from the descriptions of stigma which you've heard, but also because of the treatment or lack of treatment, facilities or lack of facilities, housing or lack of housing, support services or lack of support services, you will know that we have not given a meaningful expression to international human rights law. And finally, just in the year 2006, the world, which had resisted it for 50 years, came together and agreed, I'm carrying it with me as a kind of biblical text, the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. We've never had an international convention of this kind before. It is explicit in its narrative exposition of the rights of people with disabilities, including the mentally ill, and it has a series of simple general principles which I'd like to read to you, which underlie the content of the convention, and it covers every conceivable aspect of human activity and human behavior. The principles of the present convention shall be: A, respect for inherent dignity, individual autonomy, including the freedom to make one's own choices, and independence of persons. B, non-discrimination. C, full and effective participation and inclusion in society. D, respect for difference and acceptance of persons with disabilities as part of human diversity and humanity. E, equality of opportunity. F, accessibility. G, equality between men and women. H, respect for the evolving capacities of children with disabilities and respect for the right of children with disabilities to preserve their identities. We really crossed a Rubicon here. We've crossed a threshold into the new world for the rights of people with disabilities broadly and inclusively defined. On March 30th, 2007, this year, the new Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities is open for ratification. For all of you who are activists, you don't need to protest, you don't need to frighten anyone, and you don't need to educate them because it is explicit in content, but you need to make contact with the members of Parliament in British Columbia and remind them that Canada should be one of the first countries to ratify the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, because that then becomes a testament to our integrity on these issues. It becomes a testament to whether or not we take these issues seriously, and it is, as it were, a lesson to others to join the process. We were one of the very first countries, it was under Brian Mulroney, interestingly enough. We were one of the very first, well, I mention his name because he appointed me to the United Nations. For heaven's sakes, I am the only person you'll ever meet who is indebted to Brian Mulroney. And I mention his name with reverence because if it hadn't been for the Tories, I would still be engaging in the maniacal spasms of the left. But because I worked for 4 years for the Tories, I'm not only cleansed, I'm positively neutered, and I can therefore exercise a certain self-discipline. If we were to ratify the convention and then begin to implement its provisions, those provisions, it seems to me, forgive me, would inevitably reflect the findings of the Senate committee and their fascinating document, Out of the Shadows. And I want to say something about the issues that flow from Out of the Shadows, because every single one of them constitutes a matter of human rights.
And I want to draw an analogy for you, because you would expect it of me, of some of my international work and the way it dovetails in these issues, and give a sense of where the future battles lie. Out of the shadows, in a sense, as a document which emerged in the middle of 2006, has already been dishonored. One of the key recommendations of Out of the Shadows, to bring mental illness out of the shadows, was to create a Canadian Mental Health Commission by September of 2006. That has not been done, nor is it in immediate prospect, although there has been a consultation to discuss yet further whether the recommendation will be implemented. The Senate committee that produced Out of the Shadows also produced an explicit itinerary of financing for the new commission. They wanted it to be struck at a level of $17 million a year. And interestingly enough, $5 million of that $17 million was to go to fighting stigma. In other words, the senators themselves understood what Dr. Goldblum so aptly described, and they were devoting virtually a third of the income of the major vehicle to take society out of the shadows. They were devoting it to the struggle against stigma. But that has not happened. The money has not been voted. The commission has not been struck. And we are now in a position of wondering, given the sense of minority government on the one hand and the political struggle on the other and the possibility of an election this year, how much time will elapse before we come to grips with what was undoubtedly the best document as a basis for public policy this country has produced in some considerable time. And I also want you to note what else we lose in the process, as we always lose in the process, was the striking of a First Nations Advisory Committee for the Canadian Mental Health Commission, so that one would have a recognition of Aboriginal rights in the face of mental illness and the need to deal with First Nations and Inuit and Métis in a way which gives clear expression to our recognition of their rights and entitlements under all of the covenants I've mentioned, and particularly now under the new Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. In the meantime, the issues that are raised in the report are several in number. They're absolutely clear, they're explicit, they're definitive, and legislation can in every instance handle them. Number one, they ask for a great deal more funding. There has been very little by way of increases in funding nationally or internationally since the World Health Organization issued its report on mental health and mental illness, a very famous document in the year 2001. And what we're dealing with here, and I don't want to be qualifying my views and words because I'm lapsing into some kind of somnambulant anxiety here. I want to convey to you that what we're dealing with is a reluctance nationally and internationally to support the public sector. We're in a very difficult period at the moment. The pendulum will swing. It always swings. But the public sector is not receiving, in terms of health, education, nutrition, water, sanitation, all of the human imperatives, it is simply not receiving the funding it requires in every jurisdiction you can name. This last week, at the World Economic Forum, in Davos, in Switzerland, all of the major corporate leaders of the multinational corporations of the world were gathered, and many of the cerebral aristocrats of the political community, and all kinds of leaders of the United Nations. And they engaged in a kind of orgy of triumphalism in favor of what they called the neoliberal ethic, in favor of worrying about debts and deficits and taxes and the private sector. And there's very little time left for thinking of the human dimension, of thinking of human vulnerability, of thinking of the priorities that are required financially and otherwise around the human imperative.
And in this country, we've lost that focus as well. We're the only G8 country which has had successive budgetary surpluses for the last several years. But we cannot seem to free the money recommended by a joint Senate committee reflecting different political instincts to deal with the realities of mental illness, to bring the issue and people out of the shadows. I feel the same sense of bewilderment and anger when I watch what is happening to HIV and AIDS internationally, where because there is so much stigma associated with it, where because it's happening on a continent where there's an obvious subterranean racism at work in the response, where for whatever reasons the G8 countries make promise after promise and then betray those promises the moment they're made, millions of people have died unnecessarily, and millions will not receive treatment in time to maintain their lives, even though we have antiretroviral drugs available in generic form at costs which countries could bear if they had the capacity to distribute the drugs and if they had a secure financial flow over time. These things are felt simultaneously by the mentally ill in Canada, by people struggling with a pandemic in Africa. The second point, which is made with such intensity by the committee, is the need to move from institutionalization into the community. And everyone embraces that and watches that phenomenon work its slow and incremental way through society. I remember those intense fights deeply, personally. I worked for a number of years for a treatment center for disturbed children while I was sitting in the Ontario legislature in the 1960s and 1970s. It was very nice to make reference to my political incarnation. But my political life was one of almost transcendental futility, so I don't remember it with reverence or affection. But I do remember the tremendous battles in the 1960s of taking children out of adult wards in psychiatric facilities, or taking disturbed kids out of reform schools at the age of 7 and 8. Or taking kids out of particular treatment centers with a very strong medicalization. Or taking kids out of facilities that were clearly doing damage to their young lives and bringing them into the community. Group homes, related homes in the community. It was an extraordinary battle, which actually erupted into an election campaign. So intense were the feelings that were generated. And yay, 40 years later, we're still struggling with that reality of moving from institutionalization into the community because governments still don't make adequate preparation for the transition. They still don't provide the money that is necessary to make the move tolerable and possible for those who are at risk. And I watch it again as I did my work in Africa, where we're constantly trying to deinstitutionalize those who are suffering from HIV and AIDS because the institutions cannot possibly cope. The community does a much better job, and the hospitals and the infrastructure generally is in such disarray that the transfer to the community is vital. But again, it is a very difficult process. Number three, the senators emphasize the need for the strengthened community response. I was listening as I walked in the door to some of the discussion about coast mental health, and I was feeling to myself that this, you call it, Coast Health generally, that it does such a splendid job on so many fronts in the community where services have to be provided, where rehabilitation has to be provided, where support has to be provided, where employment has to be provided, where housing has to be found, where families have to be engaged, where everything from training families to respond to respite care for families has to be part of the compendium of knowledge and response that makes for a civilized and decent response in society. And it's fascinating for me to witness the priorities here that are mirrored in the priorities that I've watched on a continent like Africa over more than 5 years, where the intensity and depth of the community response is awesome, where the resilience and the courage at the grassroots to respond to the needs of those who are vulnerable is, it's absolutely overwhelming. And the response tends to come almost entirely from the women in the society. And they do all the work, and they do all of the caring, and they do it unacknowledged, and they do it uncompensated, but they do it. They do it with a tremendous fervor and feeling for their fellow family members and neighbors and friends and those who are struggling. And one sees in many of these extended family situations in developing countries the kind of intense community expression and engagement which is even more admirable than that which we are able to summon in advanced developed societies. But it is a testament to the invaluable importance of a community focus.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You are listening to the famous Canadian politician and diplomat Stephen Lewis in his speech titled Human Rights for People with Mental Illness, January 29, 2007.
The fourth aspect, which I found particularly fascinating, was the emphasis in the report on psychosocial responses for people who were mentally ill. Psychosocial has become the buzzword of the therapeutic industry. And it's obviously vexed by a shortage of professionals. In our countries, shortages of social workers and psychologists and sometimes psychiatrists to respond to the pressures in our own environment. But I have to say, where I've been working over the last number of years to talk about psychosocial responses is to talk of an abstraction, of an ephemeral abstraction. There are no psychiatrists. There are virtually no social workers. There are virtually no psychologists. Psychosocial response is a dream. The idea of therapeutic intervention comes only from friendly citizens and extended family in the community, and occasionally from a teacher, occasionally from counselors, the same people who do the testing to find out whether your status is HIV positive or HIV negative. And yet those people of professional talent and knowledge and learning are so desperately needed. I've thought so often of the incomparably difficult situation of the grandmothers and the orphan grandchildren in Africa, in the high prevalence countries where the pandemic is so deeply rooted. These grandmothers bury their own adult children year after year after year. The trauma is so intense it is inexpressible. And then at the age of 60 and 70 and 80, they begin to parent again because they look after the orphan grandchildren. The orphan grandchildren, on the other hand, are so profoundly traumatized themselves by watching their parents die. It's one of the most distressing, heartbreaking realities in Africa today to know that youngsters everywhere are standing in the home, standing in the huts, the mother or the father stretched out on the floor of the hut in the anguish of the last throes of life, and the young kids, they scramble around frantically to find an aspirin to relieve the pain of an opportunistic infection. They try to get a wet cloth to wipe the brow of the mother, and then they stand in the hut and they watch the mother die. And the intensity of that emotional fraying of their whole little psyche is then embraced by way of sympathetic response by the grandmother. So you have the trauma of the grandmother meeting the trauma of the orphan, millions of orphans, millions of grandmothers. It's as though we're redefining the human family. There is no historical precedent for what has happened. There is nothing in human history which has prepared us for grandmothers burying their own children and looking after their orphan grandchildren and trauma meeting trauma. And if ever there was the possibility of summoning people with therapeutic experience and therapeutic range to give some support to these grannies and to these kids, it would be a godsend. Because I have no idea what's going to happen down the road. No one can predict what's going to happen 15 or 20 years hence when the grandmothers have died. And these little orphan children are living in child-headed households where the oldest sibling in the family looks after the youngest sibling, even if the oldest sibling is only 8, 9, or 10. This business about psychosocial interventions has become one of the centerpieces of the response to mental illness here and the response to the predicament of the pandemic in other parts of the world, and yet they are bonded in similar instinct and bonded in similar frustration at not having enough people to do the work. And in Africa, having virtually no one to do the work. And yet, levels of emotional need which are simply beyond calculation. And that brings me to the fifth point, which was so carefully adumbrated by the Senate committee about the need for enhanced capacity. And how we need so many more professionals, even in Canada, to deal with matters of mental health and mental illness. And that we are compromising the lives of Canadian citizens, and we are certainly damaging their rights as articulated under all of the major international conventions, because we simply don't have enough people to respond. Don't have enough nurses. Some places don't have enough doctors. Certainly don't have enough who practice the healing arts in the psychiatric and related professional areas. In Africa, they need 1 million more professional discipline exponents, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, clinicians, community health workers. They are 1 million short. The World Health Organization has just launched a program which it calls TTR, Treat, Train, and Retain, an effort to keep in the country those who are leaving in such numbers because the conditions are so appalling, so excruciating. I have been in hospitals like the Lilongwe General Hospital in Malawi, and an overnight shift where you've got 70 people in an adult male ward, every single one of whom would be in intensive care in the local Surrey hospital. And in a 10-hour overnight shift, there is one nurse on the ward. The conditions under which people work and the absence of human capacity is overpowering. It is dramatic and apocalyptic there. It is intense and important here. What I'm trying to say is that on the continuum, obviously we're better off. But on the continuum, we still haven't responded adequately, and in other areas of the world, the absence of the response is virtually catastrophic. And the last item I wanted to mention was children. Because in the Senate subcommittee report, for children who are mentally ill and attempting to come out of it, the response of the senators was curious. They want to put it all on the school system. They want to see the school system as the vehicle for the primary response, which means all of the training and all of the adjustment and all of the adaptation which will be required. And it doesn't work that way in educational systems. You can do some of it, But you need more than that in society. And as I read that part of the report, I felt the same way about the section of the report which dealt with seniors. I thought, this has suddenly become superficial. This has suddenly become expendable. This has suddenly become cursory. What's happening here? And then I thought about the situation of children in the pandemic. There are 2,300,000 kids who are living infected in this world. 2 million of them are in Africa. If they don't get treatment almost immediately, 50% of them die before the age of 2, 80% of them die before the age of 5. Only 5% of those who require treatment are receiving treatment. You know how infants get infected in Africa? Children get infected? They get infected during the birthing process. The virus is passed from mother to child during birth. But we have drugs to prevent the transmission of the virus from mother to child. We have what we call prevention of mother to child transmission. Only 9% of all the HIV positive infected pregnant women in Africa even have access to the drugs to prevent the transmission. What is going on here? Why is it that children always bring up the bottom rung of social and economic priorities in any country or society? And we're seeing it again in this country. I mean, just throw your mind back, for heaven's sakes, to the resolution that was introduced in the House of Commons in 1989, if memory serves me, by Ed Broadbent, and supported unanimously by every single member of every party in the House to eliminate child poverty by the year 2000. And we arrived at the year 2000, and the numbers had increased in both absolute and percentage terms. There is something dreadful about the unwillingness to give to the human dimension the priority which it deserves. The analogies flow everywhere between what is happening here and what is happening in other parts of the world. But we have human rights conventions. And we have a principled community. And we have the capacity to engage in advocacy. I smiled gently to myself when Professor Goldblum said that protests sometimes invite scorn. May not have been his exact word, but I'm attempting to paraphrase with a vague integrity. I'm a protester by nature. I love a demonstration. I love a protest. I can barely live life without them. So I'm not quite so anxious about it. But I'm perfectly prepared to accept its limitations. And I'm perfectly prepared to accept the intemperate dismissal of education. And I sure as the devil accept the proposition that contact makes all the difference in the world. But the contact that should be applied now is the contact of all of us who care of these issues, who care of the human rights of the mentally ill, and know how much they can achieve on their own behalf if society rallies, then collectively we have to engage in advocacy. And I want to remind you that we're going to have an election campaign this year. I'm not going to reveal the date. I've been sworn to secrecy. But I'm going to make it the obvious truth that there is an election coming either in May or in the fall. And it gives absolutely everyone in this audience the opportunity to go to an all-candidates meeting and force the candidates to declare their positions on the issues that have been raised in the Senate report out of the shadows, and force them to declare their positions on the explicit statements that are made in the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, force them to say whether or not they will ask the government to ratify the convention, put out in the open the way in which the powers that be will respond to the rights of mentally ill persons in this society. It is an extraordinary opportunity. It's happening in this year. It's a matter of principle. It invites your collective advocacy. I wasn't here for the earlier speakers, but I got from Professor Goldblum's remarks that they were
pretty moving and telling in their words. And therefore, you understand exactly what can be done within our own society. In the countries where I've worked most of the last 5.5 years, it's an incredible struggle, but it's a struggle that you have to keep fighting. I was in Mozambique a few weeks ago. I was in the second largest city in the country, the big port of Beira, which is right in the center of the country, from which the transportation corridors move ever outwards. And as I often do, I visited the local general hospital, pretty ramshackle affair. And I went to the adult women's ward, and there were 54 beds in the ward, and there were between 80 and 90 women patients. They were lying on the concrete floor of the corridors. They were lying on the floor between the beds. They were lying on the floor under the beds. They were lying two or three to a bed. The vast majority of them were there for AIDS-related illnesses. Their families were with them. There was such a sense of congestion and agony and death that it was absolutely Kafkaesque. And I remember standing at the door of the ward and thinking to myself, has the world gone mad? All these young women, they were in their 20s and their 30s. And they were dying in such inordinate numbers as a result of gender inequality, as a result of the intense and grotesque vulnerability they face. And I know that in Africa, as in Canada, it's possible to overcome the sense of struggle if only society as a whole acts in a decent, civilized, and humane fashion. There's nothing more important in this world than the struggle for social justice and equality, whether there or here. We have the opportunity to make it happen here and to give expression to the most noble sentiments that have been expressed tonight on behalf of the mentally ill. Thank you for having me.
One is well advised to say very few words after Stephen Lewis, and so I shall, other than to say, Stephen, thank you for that call to action. Thank you for drawing on your experience in Africa to give us some sustenance and give us a sense of injustice and what we will do to react to that here as we look at human rights and mental illness. I'd like very much to ask you to join me in thanking for a moment the people from Stenberg and from Coast who have worked so very hard to produce this evening.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio, broadcasting from Vancouver, Canada, for caring people like you. You are listening to Canadian broadcaster, politician, and diplomat Stephen Lewis speaking at Realizing Our Potential, a Symposium on Human Rights for People with Mental Illness, January 29, 2007. This recording was courtesy of Stenberg College and Coast Mental Health and Semiahu House Society. The event was supported by VanNet Community Newspapers and by Channel M. Thank you for listening to The Brown Bagger on CFRO. Every Tuesday, we bring you the best speeches of Vancouver and beyond. I'm your host, Alex Smith, and I support every effort to bring mental health out of the closet of shame and into the realm of medical illness where it belongs. Please help yourself and others to understand. Tune in next Tuesday at noon for The Local Brown Bagger.